Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and today we are on to series two of My Side. Too often, football is seen as tribalistic as fans display blinkered obsession for their football team and make outlandish claims via terrorist chants that their team is by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. However, within these claims of blind faith and devout following lies eras and teams which crystallise why supporters love their team or are prepared to suffer the recurring heartache. On even rarer occasions, you find a fan of football who can see the beauty and excellence in a side who lies beyond the confines of their own club's history. My Side is an in-depth discussion with a different guest each episode about a side that made an eternal impression upon them. Either a club side over a single season or an international side at a major championships, discussing the key protagonists, the major incidents, the legacy and much more. My Side is the personal story of a love affair between a football fan and a side that defines their love of the beautiful game. Delighted to say that my co-host in series one is back again for series two. So either I'm doing something right or he loves it just that much. Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back, Stu, and looking forward to, well, I keep on saying looking forward to this one, but yeah, very much looking forward to this one as well, and look forward to the entire series.
Good, and I think, as we say with the definition of the beautiful game, I think we're right on the button with episode one of this one.
Well, we are, really, you know, and that's the thing. See, I'm hard to please when it comes to contemporary football, and but these please me massively.
Yeah, absolutely. Today's guest, regular writer and contributor to These Football Times, and I'm delighted to say that our first episode for Series 2 is going to be about a side who are synonymous with Spanish football and are probably the definitive version of Pep Guardiola's time there. With so many sides and seasons to choose from, but this guest chose a side who managed to rise above all others. Tonight we are talking about Barcelona's 2010-2011 side, and it's a big welcome to Mr. Tom Scholes. Tom, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure as always. I'm really looking forward to this, really, really been eager to talk about this and just get everything off my mind and into this.
I'm going to tell you, I know exactly how you feel. The last one we did, Steve and I did a bridging episode about Brazil, and it was almost like I had some sort of medical condition where I needed to get it out and needed to sort of almost say everything that had to be said.
Yeah, it almost becomes a bit of a self-help group almost.
I think this is going to help me more than anything.
That's what we're here for.
That's exactly it.
Here to help. So obviously you've picked your side. You know, you've gone with Barcelona. You've gone with the 2010-11. We're going to talk. Well, are going to talk in lots of detail about them. But a little bit, I suppose, before you do, just a bit of background, I guess, on your journey, your love of football, and how this side has become your ultimate footballing side.
Well, it's a strange one in a weird way. Not so much being attracted to a foreign side or an overseas side. I think we can all gladly say that, even though we've grown up in the United Kingdom for forever, we've lived here as well. We've grown up watching some of the best players ever come into these shores, seen some of the most successful and historic clubs produce some of the most historic and memorable moments and seasons. But there's always something different and something intriguing about something, whether it be a player, a club, or a set of fans across onto the continent. And I think for some people of a certain age, it might have been Juventus. It might have been Ajax for some other people. But for my generation in particular, not strictly to this team, but for my generation, it was Barcelona. And even though that, you know, I grew up in Milton Keynes, which when I was growing up didn't have a football team. We didn't have one I was 7 years old when Milton Keynes finally got a team. So by that time, I'd already embedded myself into a team already. So that was where my love went. My love went into another team and not my local team, so I kind of had that side of it. I grew up a Tottenham Hotspur fan because of family reasons, and from my dad's side, we used to go watch Tranmere Rovers play away games, mainly down south, because obviously, you know, taking a child up north, I mean, north isn't exactly, it probably wasn't the wisest but smartest decision. So that was my experience. I grew up with Tottenham, and I grew up going to Tranmere away games. So when you sit down and when you see television programmes like Revista della Liga and La Liga on the Sunday nights on Sky Sports, and you see that number 10 for Barcelona, he's got long hair, long scraggly hair, but kept neat. He's got a distinct look about him because not many people, footballer or otherwise, have teeth like him. Not many people have the ability to do what he did with a ball like he did. And for anybody my age, and probably a little bit older than me as well, Ronaldinho was the guy. Ronaldinho was the guy that you wanted to be. And it didn't matter where you were from, no matter what background you were, because of how big he was at the time and because of how, excuse me, how popular he was, you loved Ronaldinho. And I always say, if you were from my era of football and you were my age at the time, if you didn't love Ronaldinho, you didn't love football. And I know everybody says that about certain players. If you don't see, what's that quote? If you watch if you watch Busquets, you see nothing. But if you see what Busquets watches, or something, you see the whole game. Stuff like that. I'm not about that. But everybody had to have loved Ronaldinho at one point because he made it fun. He made football exciting. He made it must-watch television. And then I think for most people, that is what had their attraction to Barcelona. Because not only did you have Ronaldinho there, you had players like Samuel Eto'o, Deco, Carlos Puyol, who was probably for a different taste if you love Ronaldinho and Eto'o, but you could appreciate Carlos Puyol. But also players like Xavi, Iniesta, and Victor Valdez, who for many people would be seen as, you know, not a very good goalkeeper, but in some ways, that's, you know, if you compare him to a traditional goalkeeper, that almost misses the point of what made him so good and fitting in that Barcelona team. But then you also had players emerging like Leo Messi. Thierry Henry was signed, and then you kind of saw the formation of what would go on to be the 2010-2011 Champions League winning side. And it was seeing that and seeing how the team developed and what the peaks and troughs it went through in the final years of the Rijkaard reign, and how Pep Guardiola changed the team by just completely overhauling everything to what he grew up with and what the Johan Cruyff style was. I remember being so obsessed with that early Barcelona generation team, the first Champions League winning team, that I went back and I researched about Pep Guardiola, about the history of Barcelona, and then I stumbled across Johan Cruyff and Rinus Michels and, well, Michels, I'm still not entirely sure, even though I've done the research, I'm still not entirely sure how to pronounce it correctly. But you go and then you look at the Dutch 1974 side, and then you could go even further to like the Dutch 78 team, and then Cruyff's Ajax teams, the dream team of Barcelona that were managed under Cruyff and Louis van Gaal's Ajax, and so many different things branched off onto it. Just like I was saying, just to sum up the kind of obsession I had with this, I remember in, must have been like year 10 or year 11, English literature, we had to give, this is going to sound like such a tangent, because it is such a tangent, but it does have a point at the end of it. We had to give presentations about people that we thought were influential in one way or another, and I picked Johan Cruyff, which to us sounds completely natural. It would be silly not to go with someone like him. But at the time, it wasn't the information that we know now and what people that study the game and love the game, we recognise it and we know it just like the click of a finger. For people our age, they didn't quite understand what made these Barcelona teams so good and so special, because not only were they playing good football, they were sticking to the ethics of what their club wanted to be. And I think also now you look back at those Barcelona teams and you see not only did they play well, they were exciting, they won, but they also stuck to their club ethics and supposed morals to an extent. And there's no surprise that ever since they moved away from those those, like the men, the Cruyff mantra, so to speak, they haven't been quite as successful. And yes, they do have arguably the greatest player of all time, which, you know, there's no definitive answer to that. That's purely generational opinion. But if they've the Barcelona now is completely different to the Barcelona from when I was growing up, which, in my opinion, makes this incarnation of Barcelona, the last great Barcelona, and the last Barcelona team that made you, that you could look at and strictly say, this is what Barcelona designed themselves to be. This is the pinnacle of what they wanted to become. I think in hindsight's a wonderful thing, but hindsight's also given me the ability to recognise that, the ability to see that, and the ability to appreciate it more than when I did when I was just a wee old teenager.
I'll tell you what, Stephen, we've got the right guest here. If that's not an opening monologue for Series 2, I don't know what is.
It's the perfect scene setter, Stu.
It is. And it's funny, I mean Tom's mentioned quite a bit of stuff, and something that struck me there, and he's right, you did, no matter who you support, you know, we've discussed at great length, I don't really support anyone. You're a passionate Liverpool fan, but he's right in that there is always a your second club, which is a continental club, and it can be for the most random or bizarre of reasons. And I suppose a bit like your hometown club, your English club, whatever that is, your first choice club, and the reasons behind that. That the reasons behind your sort of almost your continental counterpart, if you like. It's exactly the same, isn't it? Everybody seems to have a favourite continental side.
Exactly. And, sorry, Stephen. I was just going to say, this again, it's another generational thing. There's probably teams that you guys appreciate and that you would say are, you know, finger quotes in the air, support, probably more admire more than anything. And I think for most people, it comes down to a player. Or, you know, a set of players that were at the club. So, like we mentioned earlier, Juventus. There's probably a lot of people now that grew up in the 80s, you know, wanting to be Michel Platini. There's probably people like myself that grew up watching Ronaldinho and Lionel Messi and were just like, this is it. This is what I want to do. And I think that plays a huge impact, and I don't think people realise it until further down the line.
So who did you want to grow up and want to be, Stephen?
Oh, I want to be everyone. that same generation you came from, Stu, you know, it's the 82 World Cup and everything that surrounded it. So all those players that, you know, grew into that tournament from 78, everyone wanted to be Kempes, everyone wanted to be, you know, Maradona as he emerged. And obviously it was Zico for me and you a lot of the time. But yeah, you know, one minute you're Platini, one minute you're Zico, you know, and the next and then. And then obviously LKR came along and yeah, blew everyone else away for a bit. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the thing about having teams that you look out for, you know, away from, you know, your own, it's almost like it's akin to a band that you like, or, you know, the play a tune that you love that and you want to hear more of it. Or it's a comedian that comes out with a cracking set and you think, yeah, I'm going to watch them again. And you do. And you follow them and you watch them and you watch them from afar. And even years on now, you know, I'll still look out for the results of Borussia Mönchengladbach. I'll still look out for the results of Saint-Étienne and many other teams like that, you know. And it is, it's an all-encompassing thing. It switches you on and it broadens your horizons from your own, not narrow view of your own team, but you become blinkered and... You know, your own team is everything, but then suddenly you see something that someone else does and then you think, oh, well, look at that, that's great. And then you'll look across the broader spectrum then and you'll start to appreciate football, you know, more than just your own team. And that's the point that we all got to, or certainly I'm at, is that, you know, I have that passion for my own team and I wouldn't change that for the world, but I'm a football fan in general as well. And it's a great way to be, to have both sides of that.
Like I say, you know, I go about it quite a lot, and I feel at times I feel really lucky that I don't support a team. Other times I feel like I'm missing out. But for the majority, like I say, of my life and my love of football, it has been as a passionate neutral. I think is probably the best way I can describe myself. A passionate neutral. So Tom. wonderful, wonderful sort of opening commentary. You know, you mentioned Cruyff. I think it's brilliant that you managed to get him into one of your GCSE English lessons. You know, a little bit about Rijkaard, but I suppose this side then, you know, really, I suppose we have to look at, you know, the appointment of Guardiola. So in terms of, obviously, you know, we're going to look at the 10-11 season in a lot of detail, but if you can just sort of give us that sort of build-up from Guardiola taking over and that almost, that build-up, that leading, you know, to as you said, the pinnacle, the, you know, that ultimate definition of the Barcelona side and perhaps the last great Barcelona side as we know it at the moment. Just talk us through the lead up to that season.
Well, I think you mentioned there, like, they were just naming people that were involved in it and everything like that. I feel with this particular team, as there probably is with every other team that you'll have in these series, there's context actually makes it somehow even more impressive. So you look at, we'll go back to when Pep took over, when he was just simply Josep Guardiola and not Pep Guardiola. That's how cool he's become. He's shortened his name there. But Barcelona are completely on the rocks. They had Ronaldinho was there, but he was considered a bad influence on Lionel Messi. And Pep came in and kind of said, look, Messi's the future. Messi is the one that we're going to build this team around. And he got rid of Ronaldinho. And, you know, young me was like, what are you doing? So my first impression to Pep Guardiola was this, like, clearly doesn't know what he's doing. What's he doing? Get rid of Ronaldinho? It turns out to be completely spot on. And, you know, Ronaldinho was never the same since. But he got rid of players that he felt didn't suit his style, didn't fit into his mantra, didn't have the desire and the want and everything like that to play for a team like Barcelona. And he had the bravery to bring up players further down the line, like Sergio Busquets, bring back Gerard Piqué from Manchester United, who wasn't getting a game. And, you know, people look at that now and they can always look back and go, oh, why did Man United sell that player? He turned out to be great. There was no way anybody could have, one, seen that rise coming. Two, he was never getting ahead of Ferdinand and Vidic, regardless of what people say. So it was the perfect move for him at the perfect time, but it was also the perfect player for Barcelona, because it was, you could have gone out and they probably could have spent a lot of money to get in Nemanja Vidic. But Nemanja Vidic isn't the type of player that Barcelona have at centre-back. Gerard Piqué is. And that's what made the team so different. And, you know, you look at it and kind of go, every player had a purpose. And every player in that team brought something different, even if they all played to the same mentality and the same style and the same mindset. So they win that first Champions League against Manchester United. I remember distinctly watching that in the ESPN Zone bar in Times Square in New York. It was full of Barcelona fans. I had a Barcelona shirt on. I was welcomed. They didn't hear me speak. They didn't hear me say a word. And I didn't say anything for 90 minutes until one Spanish fella looked at me and said, you're not leaving, you're not leaving. And as if to say, no, you're going to have to watch them lift the trophy. And I was like, oh, yeah, that happens at the end of these tournaments. So we play, but at the time, I didn't really recognise it. It was like, oh, you know, they beat Man United. That's cool. But then you go back and watch it, and you see the clips, and it's like they took them to town. They schooled them to a degree that I don't think anybody had expected that particular Manchester United team, because the team they faced a few years later in the Wembley final, it was a completely different Manchester United side. The side they beat in Rome still had Ronaldo, still had Tevez, it still had excellent players. And, you know, people often forget Manchester United was one game away from being historic. I mean, they could have easily won the treble that year if it weren't for, I think it was like a Sully Bentari penalty in the FA Cup at Old Trafford for Portsmouth. They could have done a treble quite easily. But Barcelona made Manchester United, the best team in England at the time, look like chumps. They made them look like some of the teams that I've seen play Tranmere Rovers away. You know, I don't think it was possible to make Manchester United look like Walsall, but they managed to do it. But again, the following year when they failed to beat Inter in that what I thought was a terrible semi-final at the time because my favourite team didn't go through. And so you go back again, you watch it again, and you see how different it all is when you've got perspective, and you see how Guardiola used Zlatan Ibrahimovic to try and change up his style. And as big a fan as Ibrahimovic as I am, he wasn't the fit to that team. And I think that's the perfect embodiment of what Guardiola found out that season was you can have better players. You could definitely argue that Zlatan Ibrahimovic is a better player than Samuel Eto'o. 100%, that's an argument you could make. But is Zlatan Ibrahimovic a better player in that Barcelona system than Samuel Eto'o? The evidence suggested quite clearly he wasn't, because one won the Champions League and the other didn't. So that was a learning curve, excuse me, and that semi-final loss, it kind of forced Guardiola to look a different way. It kind of looked, and he said, OK, we've got to pass, we've got to be direct, but we've got to be quick, and they've got to be interchangeable. And that's why Pedro, Lionel Messi and David Villa, that front three, was so electric, it was so outstanding, because them three on their own is excellent. They're brilliant to watch, and they're fun to watch, but them three getting passes from Xavi and Iniesta made it impossible not to appreciate them, and equally impossible to defend them. So I think the build-up to that season and to that team was the accumulation of the previous year's work for Guardiola, and the kind of it was a two-year process of chopping and changing to try and find what works, what doesn't work, what works against certain opposition, what happens against low blocks, what happens against teams that for some reason decide to play high lines against these teams. But also players like Dani Alves took on another role where he essentially just, yeah, defending, yeah, I don't know. I'm going to be basically the world's most attacking right-back. And, excuse me, he did it perfectly well. But again, that fits into that whole mantra of the system comes first, which obviously we know Pep Guardiola obsesses over, the system, the system, the system. I'm sure he's probably screamed that at Raheem Sterling's face in training time and time again. But we saw that happen, and we saw the chopping and changing, and the kind of just moving one or two little bits of the puzzle around to see what worked, see what was the best combination, see what was the most Pep Guardiola team that Pep Guardiola could make. And I think he finally had that when he got in David Villa.
We've done a lot of these, Stephen, and even though this is a very contemporary and probably the most contemporary ones that we've done, but it's you almost forget how much sort of work goes into this. You know, and we call it the crystallisation of a side, but you sometimes forget the amount of work that's been put in over the seasons to ultimately arrive at this pinnacle and this peak. One, because Barcelona feels like that they were just constantly at their peak with Pep Guardiola. But as Tom's put it there, you just forget, don't you, that actually it took a while to get to where Barcelona got to.
Well, that's it. I mean, the thing about all of these teams, the common thread is the evolution of them. You know, there is no shot-bought, great team. You know, every team that we've covered in this series, it is always about the evolution of the side. You know, Tom so eloquently put it about the 2006 side and Rijkaard's side and how elements of that were transferable to Pep Guardiola's side. But and then the elements and the ingredients that he added and took away, yes, you know, the removal of Ronaldinho, the removal of Ibrahimovic on paper doesn't make any sense, but on the pitch did. And it added to the ambiguity of those players that they were great players but were deemed surplus to requirements or the idea or the plan that Guardiola had come up with. And that there were players far more suitable to the pattern, and it is, it all comes down to that state of evolution and how things just seem to fall into place, and it makes it seem effortless almost when it's anything but.
We'll get Tom to go through the side in just one second, but I suppose to you, Stephen, you wonder whether we won't still be doing this series by then, but that's by the by. You know, when people look back, even at this Manchester City side at the moment, that the story that Tom's telling now about Barcelona is just going to be replicated again at Manchester City. You know, and you've mentioned it that, you know, Manchester City always struggled to retain the Premier League title, but under Guardiola, you know, it's something that has now been done. But it was a stepping stone.
Yeah, who's to say that, Guardiola isn't, going to be able to implement an ethos at Manchester City that might reverberate for decades to come in the same way that Cruyff did for Barcelona. You know, time will tell. But he has been the man that's basically made Manchester City be something that, you know, we've never known Manchester City to be before. You know, me and you are old enough to remember Manchester City meant something completely different once upon a time. But even in this age of riches, you know, this isn't the Manchester City of Pellegrini. This isn't the Manchester City of Mancini. You know, this is a completely different Manchester City, even to, you know, those seasons where they first had those, you know, vast amounts of riches to be able to build sides and to put fantasy football together. And Guardiola, yes, he spent money, but he's done so in a completely different manner. You know, you can't lambast him for the money that he's spent, because he's put together, you know, this beautiful, beautiful team, and he did that for Barcelona way before he did it for Manchester City. He's a serial, you know, genius, basically.
You're right, and it's a great, you know, like you say, the side that he put together for Barcelona. So usually, Tom, this is usually the guest's favourite part. How you introduce the principal 1 to 11 is completely up to you. But if you want to sort of talk us through what you would consider to be the main 11 of this side of yours.
So I went over, because I wasn't entirely sure who — this is going to sound like such a nitpicky thing — I wasn't entirely sure who played left back in this team, because I distinctly remember Maxwell and Adriano getting a couple of games. Now, I think I've had like the Mandela effect here, because I was completely wrong. It was Eric Abidal. But of course, people mainly remember Eric Abidal for that moment at Wembley when him and Carlos Puyol, you know, they lift the Champions League trophy up after, you know, Abidal had recovered from his bout with, I think it was liver cancer. I apologise if I got that completely wrong. I distinctly remember that. But, you know, you look in goal, and what you were saying there about how Pep Guardiola, rather, is creating an ethos at Manchester City, and how certain players don't work, and he's picked certain players that do work. You look at, in goal, Victor Valdes. He left Barcelona to join Manchester United, and then bizarrely Middlesbrough, and he wasn't quite the same afterwards. Because that, and I think it wasn't until the classic saying, "You don't know what you've got until it's gone," and he fit that Barcelona side perfectly. He made some good saves. He was a good goalkeeper, but it wasn't necessarily what he did with his hands that were important. That was almost secondary to this Barcelona team. It's what he did with his feet. And we've seen it at Bayern Munich with Manuel Neuer, how he's basically a sweeper. We've seen it with Edison at Manchester City, how he's basically a sweeper. Victor Valdes was more or less the same thing with Barcelona. But I think because people didn't see him do much, he was often, you know, some people called him overrated, others called him underappreciated. That's not for me to decide, because I wasn't a very good goalkeeper when I was young. In fact, I don't think I should be able to rank any of these players, because I wasn't a good player anyway. But he was the prototypical Pep goalkeeper before anybody realised it was the prototypical Pep goalkeeper. It wasn't until Manuel Neuer did it in his Bayern Munich team that people realised, hang on a minute, maybe he likes goalkeepers to play with their feet. And it's like, of course he does, because he played in the Cruyff team where the goalkeeper played with his feet. And it wasn't necessarily about what he did with his hands. So Victor Valdes was the prototypical, stereotypical, perfect Pep Guardiola goalkeeper in that respect. But one of my favourite players, and you know, this is going to be hashtag controversial opinion time, the best right-back that football's ever seen, and will probably ever see, Dani Alves. Now, feel free to disagree. I expect most people will. But my goodness, what a player he was. Honest to God, he was brilliant. He was, he's the textbook definition of marauding, because he would be up there like an absolute train. And it was perfect to watch, because him and Messi had a perfect understanding. And it was one of them understandings, I think, you know, I'm sure there's probably going to be a series on partnerships in the future. You know how everybody used to say about Toshak and Keegan, how they had a telepathic understanding. I think they went on television to do some, like, test to prove they're not actually mind readers or something like that. They have to do something like that with Messi and Dani Alves, because you see some of the combinations they play and it's like, you don't even know he's there and you're playing that back heel. How do you know? And it must be a sense thing. But again, we've seen it with his other right backs, how they bomb forward, they run forward, and they basically become right wingers or right midfielders. And Dani Alves was the first one to do it. And he set the bar so high that nobody has ever been able to replicate it. And to an extent, Barcelona are still trying to find their Dani Alves replacement. They've got Nelson Semedo now, who is good, but he's not Dani Alves, which unfortunately, for any right-back, is going to be the caveat, is going to be the little asterisk next to their names. Oh, they're good, but not Dani Alves good. And that's what made him perfect for this team. But then Carlos Puyol was the captain. But then, next to Gerard Piqué, that's what people remember being the defensive partnership. It was the typical tall, ball-playing defender in Piqué, the small, aggressive, tough-tackling Puyol, who I don't actually remember diving too much into tackles. But for the majority of the season, and who actually played more games, was Javier Mascherano, which was the first staple of the Pep Guardiola kind of dragging a defensive midfielder into centre-back. Not because they're good defenders, but because they're comfortable on the ball and he trusts them to do what they do. Excuse me, at the time of recording, with Manchester United, Manchester City, get that one right, Laporte's out injured. But they're probably not going to bring in a youth centre back. They're probably just going to drag Fernandinho back or even Rodri back. And that's the same thing that what happened with Javier Mascherano. He was signed as a midfielder from Liverpool. I think it was a relatively cheap fee as well for such a good player. But he ended up playing the Champions League final as centre-back. And even though he was quite small for a centre-back, even though he wasn't exactly quick for a centre-back in modern football anyway, Pep Guardiola had the confidence in him to play that way. And he kind of took over the Puyol role when Puyol wasn't there next to Piqué, because Piqué dealt with the majority of the on-ball duties and kind of just left Mascherano to do what every South American defensive midfielder does best, beat people and tackle them strongly and toughly and make them not want to run into them again. We mentioned at left back there was Eric Abidal, but the part of the team that I cannot get over even now is the three midfielders, who for me are the best trio of midfielders you'll see. Sergio Busquets just as a deep lying playmaker, just as the one that I took as an inspiration of, you can be good without running. And I kind of looked at it and just went, yeah, you can. Yeah, the minimum effort is actually quite a good thing. So I implemented that into my game, and it turns out, actually, no, I'm not good at either. But he was the perfect kind of Pep player. And he was, if you were to describe Pep Guardiola as a player to anybody, you would just say Sergio Busquets, just with a different face. Because that's more or less what Pep wanted, and that's what Busquets wanted to be. But it also helped that he had two of the best midfielders that we'll ever see as well in front of him, with Xavi and Iniesta. And it just saying that now just rolls off the tongue. It's like, oh, I've wanted to say that for so long. But them two complemented each other so well, because, again, they weren't the stereotypical midfielders that we'd see, that we'd grown up of. We've seen Paul Lintz, Roy Keane, Didi Haman at Liverpool. They're quite tall. So I had to throw a Liverpool player in there just to keep it balanced. But I suppose Paul Lintz counts. He played for Liverpool for a cup of coffee at one point. But they were different to what we'd seen here. And I think that added to the intrigue. I mean, Iniesta announced himself quite prominently in that controversial semi-final in 2008, 2000, whenever it was, in the first Champions League winning season under Pep at Stamford Bridge, which I distinctly remember cheering quite wildly, actually, going into school the next day and laughing at a Chelsea fan's face and not even being a true Barcelona fan, as he said. Not that I cling on to these things, but they kind of... They just... The three of them mixed perfectly, and they gelled perfectly well together. But also, as having Pedro on one side of the wing and David Villa, who was predominantly a striker at Valencia, I think what also adds to the argument that this fluid Barcelona side could complement many players of a certain style, is he just moved to the left and had Messi as the... I'm actually reading Zonal Marketing by Michael Cox at the moment, and I've just finished the Spain chapter, which is possibly why I'm going through this so fluently and so with such flow that it's all coming off the tip of my tongue and I'm remembering it so quickly. But Messi would drop back and almost act as like the central attacking midfielder slash false nine, to use one of their modern terms from Football Manager. But David Villa would be on one side, Pedro would be on the other, and they kind of just make in runs to become inside forwards, just run into the box and not always be stereotypical touchline hugging wingers. So they all complemented each other, even from the goalkeeper up until the strikers, because they all had the same role. Pedro would want to run into the inside, and Dani Alves would come back from the right midfield, right back position. PK would move over to the right back position. Busquets would drop deep into the centre back position, and it would just flow like that. And it was what people, the modern version of what total football would be. People always say it's tiki taka, and I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, because this was a lot more than just passing for passing's sake. This was pass and move. And I think, you know, you get the film, pass the ball, move the ball, and what, or I can't remember the exact title of it, but that was the perfect example of what it was. These players would get the ball, they'd look up, they'd pass it, they'd look up, they'd pass it, they'd look up, they'd pass it, and they'd always be on the move. And I can only help but feel sorry for anybody who had to defend this regularly, because it's tiring just to think of it. It was tiring to watch it. I can't begin to imagine how tiring it must have been to try and chase after these players.
I mean, it's brilliant. Like I say, I love it when people go through the side, and people have done it in all sorts of different ways. For me, I think Xavi is a wonderful, wonderful player. Whenever I talk to my students, you know, we talk about Barcelona, and the 99% of them are all about Lionel Messi, and rightly so. You know, as we've all said and agreed, wonderful, wonderful footballer, probably the greatest footballer, on his way to being the greatest footballer that's ever played the game. But for myself, it was all about watching Xavi, and it was all about efficiency of movement. It just looked such a simple game when he played. And obviously Iniesta was part of that, the movement off the ball, of, as you said, of the other midfielders and of the strikers, which makes it look so effortless. But certainly for me, that side was all about Xavi. Stephen, again, it's one of those things, isn't it, where you know probably 90% of football fans can probably name this 11, or certainly 9 or 10 out of the 11 of this side.
Oh, certainly. It's the symbiosis of the side as well. I say, you know, you both touched on that effortless kind of like pass and move basis that they operated under. It was just mesmeric. And that's the, again, going back to the thread of virtually most of the teams that we've spoken about, all the teams we've spoken about on this series. It's how they all interlink. You know, you might well have a focal point to a side, and no greater focal point, certainly the contemporary game, than Lionel Messi. But he wouldn't be half the player probably without the backup of the likes of Xavi and Iniesta. You know, you only have to look at the way that he can't quite nail it with Argentina. And he's still surrounded by some fine players, but fine players that he can't quite gel with in the way that he's gelled with players at Barcelona. And that's what it comes down to, is that it's the support cast that aren't really a support cast, the great players in themselves, but how they make that focal point sing. Messi has just been, you know, the most gifted, yet almost the luckiest player on the face of the planet for the last 15 years. And, you know, what a player, but what a team, and what teammates to be surrounded by. You know, even down to the defence that could play football. I mean, I can remember Puyol playing at Anfield in the 2001 UEFA Cup final and being roundly unimpressed with him, because he just, you know, he struggled. I think he played right back that night, which was clearly out of position, or wasn't clear at the time. But I remember him being as absolutely atrocious right back, and then he blossomed into this fantastic central defender. And then, yeah, you know, and it was, he just, each component, you know, complemented each other component. You know, they were the most symbiotic team, a club team that has played the game certainly since Ajax.
I mean, obviously we chatted with Gary about you know, the European Cup side of, you know, an Ajax 73. And you know, Tom's mentioned it right at the start, this thread, and I suppose Cruyff is almost the person that links, you know, right across from Gary's episode, you know, right through, you know, to this episode. But Tom, you've touched on Guardiola, you've touched on, you know, the way Barcelona played the game, you know, and Guardiola's philosophy, his style of play, and the influences on that, you know, are not questioned. But if you could sum up the philosophy for you for this side, how would you sum it up?
Oh, good God! I'm trying to keep it as short as possible. It's to be fast. That's one of them. That's one of the things, because it's all well and good having the ball and all well and good having possession, but if you're dawdling on it and if you're playing at walking pace, it doesn't matter. So to be fast is one of them. To be direct, to win, and to be excited. I think that's the simplistic dummy's guide to Barcelona right there, because it just... It was, when you sit back and you talk about it like we are now, it sounds so simplistic when you just say, right, the midfielders pass it quickly to the strikers who run fast and score. Okay. But then you sit back and go, actually, that is kind of, you know, that is kind of what happened for the large part of it. But it was more nuanced than that. It wasn't as blunt as that. It was patterns, it was triangles, it was partnerships all over the pitch in places that you wouldn't expect. I was just saying about the trio of Busquets, Xavi and Iniesta, but them three were hardly ever a trio. It would always be the two centre-backs, whoever were playing, and Busquets. It would be Xavi and Iniesta and Messi. That's the three. And it would either be Pedro and Dani Alves, or Dani Alves and Messi, and David Villa and Pedro, and you know, there's different combinations across the pitch because they all intertwined with each other, they all worked with each other. And I think that's what Pep wanted to do, and you could see the influence of that in the first incarnation of the first Champions League winning side, when you had Henri, Eto'o and Messi up top. It wasn't as fluid, it wasn't as quick, but they were all so talented that it worked. With Pedro, Villa and Messi, that was the perfect kind of idea of what he wanted his teams to play like. He wanted them to be quick, interchangeable, fluid, to keep the defenders on their toes, that you can't man-mark these players, but you can't zone or mark the area, because they will just time the passes and runs to perfection. The amount of times that you go back and watch them teams and you see Messi just drop back a little bit, the defence push up to create just a little bit of a high line to kind of squeeze the gap between the defence and the midfield to have Messi in that little pocket. But then David Villa would make a run and keep himself on side, and Messi would just dink it over to the inch of perfection to get it to him, and vice versa with Pedro on the opposite flank, or even Dani Alves. It was so quick. It was so fast. It was so fluid. It was like running a bath. It was just out and boom, boom, boom. Oh, it's there. It's done. Brilliant. It's everywhere. It's just constantly moving. It's swirling around. And you try to focus on one little aspect of it. It's like, I remember I heard someone describe it as, you know, when you're in a car and it's persisting it down outside, and you see the raindrops fall down the windows in the mirrors. You can try keep your eye on one of them, but eventually that's going to join up to be another thing, and they're all going to spread, and individual parts become one whole part, and you can't keep up with it. Even though you can try to keep up with it, you'll lose track of it in the end, and that one split second that you lose track of it, it's gone. And that's what this Barcelona team was like. It was quick. It didn't have the overindulgence of stars that the dream team had. There was no fight between, you know, this version of Romario and this version of Stoichkov. There was nothing like that. Because even though that Pep, just like Cruyff, liked to indulge in individual talent, he would indulge in individual talent to a degree. You can be the free roaming player, but you have to play this way. And I think that's what he wanted to do. He wanted Messi to be his star, the same way that Cruyff had Romario and he had Stoichkov and he had Laudrup. But the difference is, Cruyff fell out with Laudrup because he didn't play the way he wanted him to play. Messi play the way Pep wanted him to play, because Pep's football is how Messi wanted to play. So it's kind of the mutual understanding and that kind of aspect of it. And I know I said this is probably the pinnacle and the peak of that Barcelona team, and it's probably the last greatest Barcelona team, but you can still see the remnants of it now in two particular players, because a friend of mine is a season ticket holder at Chelsea, and a couple of years ago we went to go see Chelsea-Barcelona at Stamford Bridge. It was a Champions League knockout game, and I just said to him, look, mate, I just want to see Messi once. And I've seen Ronaldo. I wasn't that impressed. I want to see Messi. I just want to say I've done it. And he scored. It was the first time he'd ever scored at Stamford Bridge. And we got back to his house, and BT Sport were talking about how good Messi was and all the movements. And I remember coming back from that game going, but Sergio Busquets still plays like he did 10 years ago. And it's exactly the same. And it's exactly the same patterns. It's just with different players. And that is the model of what Pep Guardiola wanted to do, and that's what Pep Guardiola has managed to do. He's managed to be able to kind of go, right, you slot there, you slot here, you slot there, and everything like that. And that pretty much started to work to perfection with this Barcelona team.
One, I'm not going to be able to drive the car in the rain now without picturing Barcelona, which could cause quite a few problems. Stephen, I keep going back to it, but it's, I'm not saying there's an element of luck in this, but you know, Tom's just said there, you've got the right manager who wants to play the game in the right way, and he has the right set of players who can play the game, but also want to play the way that the manager also wants to play. There is that. I'm not saying Barcelona are a lucky side or anything like that, but it does take almost once in a lifetime, once in a generation, relationships or the coming together of player and manager to produce football of this level and this quality.
Yeah, it is a, you know, once or twice in a generation. You know, we can look at Fabio Capello's AC Milan that, you know, they had the hammer blow of Cruyff's dream team almost in that iconic 4-0 against them in the 94 European Cup final. You know, there are other instances of these teams, but, you know, perfection is very, very hard to attain. But it can be done on a simplistic basis. It's mad to say that, but the best football ideas are the simplest ones. You know, you can sit, I'd employ you to go to a football match, you know, find a seat that's high up in the stand so you can virtually see over the game, and just ball watch is the way to do it. You know, people say, you know, watch and look across the broader span of the pitch. Yes, that's fine, but just go to one match, pick a fine team to watch, just follow the ball and look at the shapes that surround the ball, and it happens over and over again. I mean, I watch Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool at that type of you know, kind of velocity. I watch it from the upper tier of the main stand, and you're watching above, and you see all the shapes that surround the ball. It goes from a triangle to a square to a rectangle. It will elongate. It will contract. It will turn into a rhombus. It will be a hexagon all of a sudden, and it changes from seconds, 3 seconds. And it changes, and the players, and like Tom said, with the Barcelona side of everyone says it was Busquets, Xavi, and Iniesta. But, you know, yes, it was. But the ball moves to a different part of the pitch, and a different shape surrounds the ball, and that Barcelona was exactly the same. It's all to do with the personnel and the shapes and that surround the ball, and where those shapes take the ball, and eventually it is the back of the net.
I've written about a few teams, and to me, I always liken sides like this to almost like kaleidoscopes, where, you know, as a kid you would look through it and you'd twist it and it's just a whole mess of plastic at the bottom, and then all of a sudden you twist it and there's this, you know, wonderful geometric shape, and you twist it ever so slightly and it just disappears and the shape's gone and something else is there instead. And you're right, watching, you know, from high up, and you look at the green of the grass and these little pieces of colour that just sort of seem to have random movement, and then all of a sudden this wonderful shape or image appears and then it disappears.
There is nothing random about it, though. This is that's the great thing about it. It's not random, but it's not, you know, people try to overthink football almost, and this is what the likes of Guardiola do and Cruyff has done, you know, in his day, is that you take you know, that overcomplication of football out of the equation, and you simplify it in some manner. And the simpler it seems to a player, the better they will play, and the better your team plays. And yeah, it's a simple way of playing football, but, you know, yes, there's more to it. But upon occasions, no, there isn't.
So, Tom, you know, we've set the scene. You know, we've got there. We've named our players. So I suppose, you know, all that's left for us really then is to talk us through some of these key moments in this season. Certainly, your memories of some of the key games through this 2010-2011 season.
I think with this team and with this season, it's key to just focus primarily on the Champions League campaign, because that's what's remembered for. The group, you know, if this is going to sound as standard as possible, and this is going to sound like maximum points, Copenhagen, Rubin Kazan, Panathinaikos. Forgive me, but I'm not going to go into them games into much detail, because I think we all know how they ended. But into the last, they played Arsenal into the last 16, and it was the first leg was at the Emirates, is when Arshavin scored that winner. I might be wrong in this. I think that's the game that they wore a mint kit in. It was like a mint green kit, and it looked iffy, I suppose the best way to put it. It was a bit weird, but Arshavin scored a winner in it, and I remember distinctly everyone kind of going, oh, you know, Arsenal are going to win, they're going to beat that Barcelona team. Yeah, up came the second leg, and Messi tore them to pieces. It was a joy to watch, more for, you know, on a personal level, it's all right. But then it's like, that's the game that Van Persie gets sent off, where, you know, he kicks the ball into the net, the whistle supposedly goes, but he doesn't hear it, and he gets his second yellow. That's what happens. So they dispatch Arsenal into that round, into that, almost with ease, in a way. They beat Shakhtar with even more ease, on 6-1 on aggregate. And there was five different scorers in the first leg, because, you know, Xavi, Iniesta, Alves, Seydou Keita, who is an often underrated member of this team, and Piqué, you know, they managed to score, you know, five of their goals with players that weren't Messi, Iniesta, Messi, Villa and Pedro, which was impressive. But, you know, what I mainly remembered for is the semi-final and the final. And this was at the period where El Clasico was at its peak. There was seemingly El Clasicos every week. And this was when Jose Mourinho was in charge. And this was when he finally figured out... This was the season they beat... Barcelona beat them 5-0 earlier in the Nou Camp. And it was embarrassing for not only Jose and his reputation, considering that he was turned down for the Barcelona job before Pep, which is why he has that... just obsessive hatred of them, but also for Real Madrid, because it's bad enough to lose to Barcelona anyway. It is even worse to lose 5-0. So they had to change how they played in these semi-finals, and Real Madrid came out quite negatively. But, you know, Messi scored twice at the end, mainly because Pepe, the Portuguese hard man, I suppose he would like to be called, he was playing like a central defensive midfielder role, but not in the same way that Busquets was. Busquets was taking the ball and dictating play, whereas Pepe was solely a stopper, you'd say a traditional South American defensive midfielder that would, you know, get the ball, he'd tackle, he'd fight, he'd be, you know, the strength in the midfield, and someone else would do the passing. He got sent off with a bit of a melee with Dani Alves. It was quite a high challenge. And I think he overran the ball and Dani Alves nipped in. And I don't think he meant it as much. But then we can never be too sure with these games what's meant and what isn't meant. But he was sent off. And him being taken out of that central defensive midfielder role kind of freed Messi up to essentially do what he wanted, because that was the entire gap between the midfield and the defence free for him to do. And hit the third. They won the first leg 3-1, and the second goal, the second Messi goal, it's one of my favourite goals. If you remember, it's one where Messi kind of like slalom past everyone, and then he's just right foot, weaker foot, tap under Casillas, and it trickles in. But my favourite part of this goal isn't the run, it's not the finish, it's not the celebration of him running, laughing at the Real Madrid fans. It's Sergio Busquets, because he officially gets credited with the assist by stopping, turning to his right, putting the studs on the ball, rolling it a yard to Messi and letting him go. That is me. That's what I think. That's why I love him, because I'd like that if he counted as an assist if I did it. But then they move on to the final at Wembley, which, you know, it's iconic for so many different reasons. It was symbolic as well because Manchester United had won their European Cup at the old Wembley. Barcelona had won their European Cup at the old Wembley. So this was the first time that they got to face off against one another in new Wembley, especially considering that many people fancied Manchester United because of revenge reasons. I think that was the main reason. But to me, that why I focus entirely on this team and on this Champions League campaign is because of this match. Because I remember watching this game as quite a young football fan, but understanding different, finding, you know, I was at that age where tactical analysis moved from the screen on Football Manager into actually being able to watch football on television and kind of understand what's happening and understand what's going on. And like you were saying, Stephen, understanding the patterns and how nothing is random in teams as good as this and as the elite teams. And this was I've yet to see a performance better than this. I've seen individual matches more exciting than this because of drama and, you know, everything like that. But in terms of performance from an individual team, nothing has beat this match because it was the pinnacle of what Pep Guardiola's career was. Even now, he could win the Champions League with Manchester City, which I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not to be predicting or anything like that, but it remains to be seen. Even if he did that with Manchester City, it wouldn't trump this game, because this is what Barcelona, the entire club, had built for a performance like this. Not the win against Sampdoria, not the win against Arsenal in Paris, not the first game against Manchester United, although that came quite close, this win against Manchester United, because it was what everyone has different opinions of what football is, how it should be played. This, for me, is if an alien came down to Earth and came up to you and said, Tom, I've got one question. Okay, what is it? Show me what football is. You put them towards this game, because it's an absolute masterclass. It's a clinic of a match. You know, Messi scored. I think Pedro got a goal in that one as well. So, and Villa obviously scored. He got a great goal in that as well. So it was a peak, kind of the fluidity of the attacking players, all scoring and all getting from the team on the score sheet, but from different positions, different positions surrounding on the pitch anyway. And you know, Sir Alex Ferguson said that the best team he's ever faced, and I'm not someone that's going to disagree with Sir Alex Ferguson. So if he says they're the best team he's ever faced, then they're the best team he's ever faced. They're probably the best team that anybody's ever faced, because they were exciting, they were quick, they were fluid, like we've mentioned before, but they were also winners. And that is what I think sometimes people forget, is that yes, they had this element of fluid and exciting, and they wanted to be attractive, they wanted to play with flair, but they had to do it for the purpose, and they wanted to play with that style to win. When people say, oh, he's a winner, they usually think of like the Mourinho kind of apprehensive defensive style, do what you can to get the result, whereas this is just as equally valid to become, you know, as a winning team, because they played with a purpose. It wasn't pass back, pass sideways, pass forward. It was with purpose, it was with pace, and this is what this game personified in a way. Kind of the different movements that was going on, the different patterns that were created, it all peaked on this night. And the best thing about it was seeing them lift Puyol, seeing Carlos Puyol and Eric Abidal lift the Champions League trophy. And one of my favourite filmed shots in football is that the camera just pans out a little bit and you can see the arch. And it was not only from a visual point of view, very pleasing, but from a football point of view, it was a win for football and humanity in a way.
It's a wonderful summing up of, and you're right, it's incredibly difficult to sum up an entire season, no matter what side it is, and certainly was that. And I think, you know, in terms of that Champions League performance, the Champions League final performance against Manchester United, and I have to agree with you, it's probably the best club side, the best club performance that I've ever seen. And in a moment, Tom, I'm sort of going to ask you about the legacy and where you see the legacy of this side. But before I come to that, Stephen, it's always difficult and it's always so subjective, but where do they rank? And certainly if you look at that performance against Manchester United in the final, in terms of great club sides, where does this side sit for you?
Oh, they're up there on they're up there with the very best. You know, I think that that plateau of teams that can be, you know, ranked as kind of like the finest, whether that's, you know, the Meikles, Kovacs, Ajax, you know, Capello's, AC Milan, you know, the Real Madrid of the late 1950s that won those first five European Cups. You know, so many other sides that could be added to that. You know, the Bayern Munich of Beckenbauer and Müller, you know, the Liverpool of Paisley, you've got to throw them in there as well. There's so many of these sides, and you know, that Guardiola Barcelona is amongst those for me. You know, it is the finest contemporary side, certainly the finest side this side of the millennium, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think it says everything that no matter what Guardiola's done after leaving Barcelona and how fantastic it can be, as we've said with Manchester City, it all still feels like a tribute to that Barcelona that he put together. And that's just the way it will always be, I think.
It's a great point that you make, and as always, and obviously you and I are older, and I certainly have this assumption that really football's not the same. Football is slightly different to when you and I were watching it as a teenager, and there's this assumption that actually, you know, the sides were better, or it was more difficult to win the European Cup. But to me, this Barcelona side do, as you've just said there, completely contradict. You know, and you've mentioned the Ajax, the Liverpools, the AC Milans, yeah, and all of a sudden you have this contemporary side.
What you do is you get these sides that transcend the era. And, you know, people will look back on this Barcelona in 20, 30 years' time, 40 years' time, as we now look back on Ajax, as we now look back on all of those great sides of the 60s, 70s and 80s. This Barcelona will stand that test of time. And just going back to kind of like that European run, I think one of the amazing things was that people used to turn around and say that, you know, that Barcelona and Guardiola struggled away from home in Europe. And they didn't always get the results, but they didn't always extend themselves. They felt that they'd just blast everyone at home and they would do just enough away. But, you know, that semi-final at Real Madrid just completely took that off the table because it was a hypnotic victory. And then to validate that in the final against what was, as Tom says, you know, still a very good Manchester United side, probably Zenith Manchester United. They've never quite been the same since then. They added another league title 2 years later, but it was won almost on autopilot and by habit, you know, of what had gone before. But I think that was the last great Manchester United side that they dismantled, they took apart there.
We're just reaching the hour point now, and we're just going over the hour, but I think it's really, really important that before we finish, we always finish with a single standout, the single standout moment for you from this season. So obviously, Stephen, you've got plenty of time to think about it, because I'm going to get going to ask Tom to answer another question first. But before we come to both your standout moments, I suppose, and again, you know, the way you've spoken, Tom, and, you know, the passion that you have for this side, and I'm quite interested for this. And then Stephen's mentioned a little bit about how this side's going to look in, or how this side is going to be appreciated in 30, 40 years' time. But for you as a fan of this side, what do you see as the legacy of this side?
In a weird way, I had one answer before Stephen started talking, and then I came up with a second. So thank you for the influence on that one.
He does that. One,
He has that impact. I've noticed that.
He does.
But the first one is, like, this is going to be this generation's Ajax of the 70s. This is what everyone's going to look at and go, that is when there's a next football revolution, that's what people will want to play like. And people always look at this team and these players and the manager, and they'll never get any better than this. Even Messi, even though he still continues to produce incredible performances and statistics, he's arguably never been better than when he was under Pep. Pep's never been this good. Pep's managed to hit, you know, 100 points with Manchester City and win a domestic treble. not a domestic quadruple because the Community Shield doesn't count, but a domestic treble. He's done incredible things with Bayern Munich, and he's still compared to this Barcelona team. He's still compared to how they performed then. But I think the second thing, this is the Stevenham influence on this answer, is that you go back and look at every team that Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United faced and had duels with. He knocked Liverpool off their perch like he said he would. He beat Arsenal out. He beat Chelsea out. He managed to topple Man City very briefly before he retired. He took down Newcastle. He took down Blackburn. He somehow managed to win that Champions League against Bayern Munich. But the one team that he never, ever got the best of was Pep's Barcelona. And off the top of my head, it's the only team he's actually willingly and openly praised and kind of gone, these are amazing. Every time he's done that, there's always been a bit of a dig there. There's always been a bit of a, they're not quite my team, but they're a good team. This is the only team that I can remember him saying, no, these are the best team that I've ever faced. And I think that's the defining legacy, that when you think of all the players or the teams or the other managers that that man has come up against, all the battles he's had, and this is the one that he couldn't beat, then I think that says it all.
Brilliant. I mean, sometimes it takes, not an outsider, but like you say, someone so well-schooled in football, someone with so much wealth of experience, someone like you say who has, without sounding trite, but been there, seen it and done it. And when like you say, you listen to certain people and you listen to certain people's opinions and you value their opinions. And it's at times like that that you realise it's not a blinkered appreciation of a side, but you are actually seeing what literally the rest of the world is seeing. And I think, and obviously you, Tom, take great comfort in that, you believe that this side is the best side you've ever seen. And certainly you plead that case, wonderfully. And I think that, like I say, I think that they're a wonderful contemporary football side. And I think that you're right, that's the legacy right there, when what you think you're seeing is actually backed up by the entire population. It's not a blinkered view, it's a world view. And I think you're right, I think that's probably when you know that actually this is a truly great side, because everybody's seeing exactly what I'm seeing.
Yeah, and I mean, not to disagree with Sir Alex Ferguson, my Football Manager CV does, put his into pale in comparison. But I don't think that counts in the real world. But no, I think that is it. When you have someone like him, who's notorious for mind games, just flat out coming and saying these are amazing, then you kind of sit there and go, yeah, they are actually.
Tom, it's been brilliant. The reason why Steve and I do this, although when we first came up with the idea, it was just because we just like talking about football. But from episode one, the passion that comes across in these conversations is what sort of entertains Steve and I and why we enjoy doing it. And it, like I say, from the opening line to your sort of concluding comments, it's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant to listen to you to talk about this side. But like I said, before you go, I am going to ask you for your single standout moment. But as Stephen's had a little bit of time to think about it now, Stephen, for you, last thing, your standout memory of this particular side.
I was going to go with Messi's performance in the semi-final first leg against Real Madrid. That was just so all-encompassing and so, metronomic, that it was a work of art all in itself. But having watched some of the footage just as a reminder over the last couple of days before doing this podcast, at the final whistle of that final at Wembley, when Guardiola and Ferguson embrace and shake hands, the look on Ferguson's face isn't one of kind of like dejection, of torture, having lost the final. He's just absolutely beaming. He's smiling, because of what he's just seen. And it was one of those performances that just takes away the fact that they've beaten his own team. And it's just the joy of football on a beaten manager's face in the Champions League final there.
what a great selection that is. Okay, Tom, you now have the rest of the entire season, bar the look on Alex Ferguson's face, to choose from for your standout moment.
I could be creative, but I don't think I'd be as creative as that one. That didn't even come into my mind. But it does come from, I know I've got the entire season, but it does come from that match. And it's Messi's goal. It was, at a time, it sounds weird to say it now, because it seems like he's been known as one of the best ever, forever. But there was a brief period of time where people did doubt him. And there was a period of time where people kind of went, he's good, but how good is he? And he scored that goal against, in the final, against our champions, against England's champions. And it was a beautiful finish against one of my favourite goalkeepers, Edwin van der Sar. And it's not the goal itself, it's his celebration. Because he's always been he's always celebrated well, but I don't think I've ever seen him celebrate with as much passion in his face. In his just, when you see people that have scored and they just lose control of their body. I think that's what happened with him. And he just runs, he's holding the badge in his hand, he's screaming, he's kicking the advertising horn in. And it's so un-Messi-like. It's more Kitspire-like, the older, if anything. And I doubt them to have been in a conversation together. But I think that the kind of the overjoy and freeness of how he looked when he scored that goal, in a weird way, sums up that team, where when they're allowed to be free, when they're allowed to be who they are, it just floods out. The emotion comes out. And that, the goal in the semi-final was mesmeric, as was Sergio Busquets' perfect ball roll to him. But the emotion that comes out of he's only scored against a great team. He scored on a great occasion in a great stadium, but he's proving people wrong. At an age where it was make or break in his career. And I think that's the moment that should define him and should be when he turned from he's one of the best in the world to he's one of the best of all time.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Tom, thank you so much. Thank you for agreeing to do it. Thank you for putting together such a compelling discussion about this wonderful side. And I'm sure, it'll have brought back, some great memories, even despite the fact, like I say, that it still seems so recent. And yet, from the way you've been talking, some of the subject matter, you think, oh, actually, yeah, it was actually that long ago, or yeah, actually that was going on in the build-up, the transition from Rijkaard and so on. And these are things that, that you forget, because like you say, you associate Guardiola and Barcelona just with winning. It seemed like that's all they ever did until he left, and that's it. But thank you, like I say, so much for agreeing to come on.
My pleasure. Any time to talk about these lot, I'll take it.
Brilliant. Stephen, as always, thank you for interjecting with wonderful anecdotes and comments and thought-provoking discussion.
Oh, joy as always, Stu. We get this isn't work. This is an hard work. just a joy to do.
It is. What better way to spend a rainy Wednesday night than just chatting about one of the greatest football teams that have ever played the game?
Exactly. A joy as always, Stu.
Brilliant. All that's left for me to say is to thank everybody for listening, and please join us again for the next episode of My Side with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.